Hunted by the Kraken, the sinister leader of the Rule Empire, Beverly Jordan must control her powers, known only as the Priori, to survive. Believing her powers fit only for destruction and ruin, Beverly and her brother Charlie set off on a journey to find the fabled haven of Kriana, an underwater world where one can learn to split the fabric of time and manipulate the lines of power, where winged alequines soar through the air and the shadows lurk in waiting for someone to release them. Will Beverly escape the grasping clutches of the Kraken? Or is she destined to become his weapon? Chapter 15. Shadows. On tiptoe, I crept down the hallway to the narrow chute in the corner, avoiding a glance at the mind-enthralling pictures I passed.
Level 2,
I whispered, and was whisked down the chute. In an effort to remain silent, I tried to still my rasping breath and peered through the dim light emitted from the globes on the second level. I could just identify the door of the lecture hall. The hair on my neck stood on end, just as it did every time I was alone. Human-like shadows flitted about in the flickering torchlight on either side of the door. At times like these, I relied on my hearing to tell me if anyone was truly there. I cursed my inability to remember to collect my possessions, in this case my journal. It had reached the point where Carmel just picked mine up with hers, but today she was sick and I had forgotten. So now, I found myself in a cold hallway in my blanket and nightwear, trying to break into my lecture hall, all the while watching over my shoulder for imaginary eyes. In cautious rushes from one shadow to the next, I moved towards the door. At the end of the day's lessons, apprentices were not allowed to roam the halls, regardless of whether they lived at the academy or not. The teaching halls were off-limits to all who did not have permission, which I did not. Though I wasn't keen on being thrown out of the academy lodging for flaunting the rules, I really needed that journal, or I'd be on the receiving end of Adept Hiting's apprentice in a globe trick. After my last bout of embarrassment at the park, I deemed it prudent to avoid the situation at all costs. Just as I reached the threshold, my hand stretched out, the doorknob turned. Paralyzed, I realized that whoever came through that door would catch me stiffened in this ridiculous position. A shadow burst from the room and retreated down the hall. Eyes wide, I turned to watch the human-shaped shadow, unattached to any being, draw further out of sight with an object held in what I can only surmise was a hand. On closer inspection, I recognized my journal.
Hey!
I yelled, snapping out of my reverie and dashing after it.
Hey, that's mine!
The dark head turned to look over its shoulder and increased its speed. Another person would have lost the shadow in the flickering lights of the torches and the soft glow of the globes. But sighting a dragonette's shimmering camouflage was second nature to me, and I followed the shadow with ease. The gap between us didn't change, even though I pushed myself faster. It wasn't long before I was lost in buildings I had never visited. The shadow's shape constantly changed in the uncertain light, from fat to thin to tall to squat. It was clear following the shadow's shifting form that I was justified in my assumptions of being watched, though the twins noticed nothing when I mentioned it. If there were more of these shadow people, everyone could be under observation. The shadow dashed from the cover of an alcove and opened a heavy door made from the silver wood of an ice tree. It disappeared, closing the door behind it. Not halting to consider why it had chosen this particular door, I pulled at the door handle. It barely moved. Shrugging my aching shoulder, I gripped the handle in both hands and pulled with all my strength. How did a mere shadow open it with such ease? The door creaked open. Conscious the shadow would be getting an ever-increasing lead with my stolen journal, I willed it to move faster as I lent my entire body weight into my pull. After several agonizing moments, the gap was just wide enough to let me squeeze through. My back foot cleared the threshold as the heavy door swung back in. The unmistakable sound of a lock clicking into place froze me. I spun around and rammed my body against the door. My feet skidded against the tiled floor, losing their grip and bringing me to my knees. I could not even see the lines of power against the wood's reflective surface to unlock it. The door was immovable. Levering myself up to stand on throbbing legs, I reluctantly turned to face a room rather than the passageway I had expected. Cavernous and circular, the domed ceiling disappeared into the shifting blue light of the water-filled roof high above. Pitted sandstone columns held up the roof and encircled a round platform in the middle of the room. A set of 5 concentric steps surrounding the platform and the platform itself were inlaid with a mosaic of complex spirals and brilliant colors that merged into each other. At the center of the platform stood a silver stand with a bright circle of aqua light shining down upon it. 3 clawed feet formed the base, their legs intertwined to form the central pole. As the central pole touched the top of the stand, it split into 3 strands that curled down. An object rested on the stand, seen between the intricate pattern of the silver. Mesmerized, I ascended to the platform 1 slow step at a time, my footsteps echoing through the room. Tensing my shoulders, I ventured into the bright circle of light and reached my hand out to brush the object that occupied the stand. It was a book, the cover made of a black velvet material, soft and warm on the skin. Embroidered in the middle of the cover was a shape I knew well, a circular blue-silver ball radiating light, with a spherical symbol in the middle, the form manifested by the priori. With trembling fingers, I opened the book. Written on the first page in simple lettering was a stanza. The first letter of the top line was larger and embellished in gold, delicate leaves twining around the letter's edges.
Once the Kraken's evil has won, the priori gathers for the chosen one, to set free those who wish for the peace and love of life's one's hand, to destroy his evil and lock away the bad.
Underneath, a solitary line read, for the one who dared seek a better life.
To destroy his evil and lock away the bad.
I repeated. The soft words reverberated in the expanse. Flipping to a page at random, I began to read. For conducting dangerous experiments against the expressed wishes of his superior and inadvertently killing 30 people, the Kraken was banished from the magic community and condemned to live the rest of his life among those who would hunt him if his powers were revealed. So it was that the Kraken began his brief, undignified life, barely scraping together a living as a traveling magician. By ill fortune, the Kraken came across a ring in the wares of a wealthy travel merchant, a ring he knew well. The Trinity of Brethren had disappeared from the careful watch of the magic community 10 years ago. The wearer was graced with immortality for as long as they wore the ring. Free from aging, sickness, and injury, but not immune to a killing blow, the Kraken killed the merchant and took the ring for his own. Using the ring's magic, he gained influence in a new army faction that had formed in the Rule Empire. When promoted to a new post, he would offer the ring to a higher-ranking officer, pretending to court favor. Several weeks after they had placed the ring on their finger and had advanced the Kraken through the ranks, he killed them. The official would morph into a shadow, insubstantial, unable to talk, and repelled by the ring, so no revenge could be sought. They fled. Believed to have disappeared in one scenario or another the Kraken had orchestrated. As each new official disappeared, the Kraken moved higher. By the time he had reached second in command, he had gathered a dangerous following of foul creatures and greedy men. It took but a year to overthrow the organization and place himself, the Kraken, as the head of the rule army. I gripped the stand, the page's significance overwhelming me. This was how the Kraken had escaped detection by the protectors, who would have been looking for any large shows of magic. By using a sword to behead the officials, he avoided notice and manipulated those who could not defend themselves against magic. This was how he had time to build the weapon, how he killed over 3/4 of the protectors, driving the rest into hiding. Then he had placed himself in power as the feared dictator of the innocent non-magic world. None on the surface had any power that could rival his. On the surface, there were rumors that the Kraken was immortal, indestructible, but the rumors always insinuated it was because of the weapons he possessed. Yet this book was telling me it was because of his possession of the Trinity of Brethren. The fact that he was not as all-powerful as the world thought did not make him any less dangerous, for the passage also showed him to have immense cunning. My shaking hands could not be stilled as I read on. He killed all who dared to speak against him in the same way he killed the officials, creating a community of shadows who could only watch and despair. None could see them save for the most powerful of mages, who had all but died out. Eventually, he took over the ambitious country and set about persuading other nations to succumb to his great empire. One by one, they submitted to his will except one country which would not capitulate. The Kraken, impatient, decided to instill fear instead of diplomacy, a weapon he had developed in his mind in those long years as he lived a squalid existence, was released. He killed all the magic folk in his vast empire, letting the news trickle slowly back to Rayita, the defiant country. The weapon forced Rayita's magical protectors and shadows to flee beneath the salt water, which no weapon or magic could penetrate, leaving the surface defenseless to the Kraken's onslaught. Rayita fell, and the known world groveled at his feet. However, the magic he had sent forth into the world still evades him at every turn. Until the Priori is in his power, he will not be invincible. He will not be all-powerful. He can be overthrown and lose his empire, and he too can be banished to the cursed form of a shadow, meaningless, alone, and never able to return to the world of the living. With his transition into the shadow world, those he trapped in the shadow realm will be released at last, able to seek the river of death that will free them and lead them to a better place. So those of the Brethren constantly seek for the one who can free them from the prison, their miserable existence, their curse. This is the chronicle of the Brethren, the people of the Shadow Realm. The chronicles contain all information that might, will, and can be used by the Chosen One. Use it wisely and only in a time of great need, for the book contains many disturbing prophecies and predictions that may not come to pass. Farewell, great mage. Closing the book with a gentle hand, I turned to where I knew they would be. There were rows and rows of them, filling the empty space below the platform.
I can see you, but I can't save you.
I addressed the brethren, head bowed. As one, they all shook their heads decisively, hope and resolve evident in the way they moved, the way they stood.
I can barely control the priori, let alone defeat a powerful enchanter.
One of the shadows sidled to the platform and thinned out until he formed a black square in front of the bright light. Little by little, parts of the shadow retreated, leaving gaps in the fabric for the light to shine through. When the transformation had finished, I was faced with a message across the black screen.
Take the book, if not for you, then for us. You may not see it yet, but you will free us, though how you will achieve this is clouded.
I can't do what you want,
I said, my voice sharp. I was sick to death of all the prophecies and the visions of the future that whirled around me, all of them insubstantial and never explained. So many expectations and nothing clear.
I don't know how.
The shadow reshaped itself to proclaim a new message.
You are the only one left. You are our hope, and you will find a way. Do not fear. We will watch over you until you are done. We are grateful for the chance to be seen again. You are the first for a long time. Thank you.
As quickly as they had appeared, they were gone, melding back into the darkness with barely a stirring of the air. Left alone in the middle of the pool of light, I cradled the book in my hands. One remaining shadow pushed the door open as easily as if it were a curtain, and beckoned for me to follow. Deep in my own thoughts, I fretted over the race of beings who believed I was their savior. I sighed, shoulders slumped. I could not convince them of their misplaced faith, just as I could not convince Shima and Arabella, who were as sure as the shadows. If only I had that confidence. If only I had the control I needed, and the courage. But I did not control the priori. It controlled me. Thoughts of me, or anyone I knew going to the surface, made me shake. The shadow stopped, its head cocked to the side, listening. It shooed me into the dense shadow of a wall niche. Master Carp strode past, his face set like thunder, my abandoned blanket in his hands. It was the first time since being in the room that I was acutely aware I was in pajamas and wandering through restricted access buildings. We glided along on silent feet until we reached my lecture hall. There, the sheepish shadow handed me my journal. Insubstantial arms urged me to the chute and blended with the regular shadows before I could say goodbye.
Fare thee well,
I sent silently. Wind whipped my hair as I rose through the chute.
Hello and welcome to episode 20, chapter 15. With me is Colin Smith.
Hello.
Kevin Powell. Lois Spengler.
I'm not some old British explorer, no.
And Emily Craven. I'm afraid I must apologize. Sam will not be joining us this evening. I am David, the intern of Awesome.
And?
Are you alone, David?
And my Alequine Bubble.
Okay, thank you.
Say hello, Puffles.
How you doing?
What about Beverly losing her journal?
Mm.
We've all been there. And frankly, that's modelled on the fact that I would forget my head if it was not attached to me by a neck. One of the latest things was we went to the Day on the Green on Saturday, and we decided to leave a couple of songs early so that we could get out before the rush of cars, and we got to the car, and what happens? There are no keys.
Oh, so bad.
Oh, God. So, yes. Yes.
I take it you recovered the keys?
We did. Thank God. It was no calling of the RACQ or...
Where were they?
They were just sitting on the hill in the grass. Just sitting there.
Good ending, though. Oh,
it is one of my most hated things ever, that losing stuff in the pit of my stomach just going, blah, there's something in your life that's gone forever.
How good was the revelation of why Beverly's been haunted? Like,
she was not paranoid. She was being followed.
And not by a malevolent presence.
Yeah, I love that.
I must admit that I got goosebumps doing the spirits when I was voicing them, and I got goosebumps again listening to it.
Yeah.
You know, because
so she hasn't been crazy. There have been people following her, and she is kind of having dual chosen one scenarios being thrust on her. First one is she's got the priori, and she's kind of like, dudes, I just need you guys to back off, and now there are these strange creatures that are like, you are our chosen one, and she's like, oh my God, not again.
Responsible for the fate of both the living and the dead.
But I do like how this connected to chapter 13, where you learn about the Trinity of Brethren, and then you're like, well, of course the Kraken has to have had this temporary immortality ring. Who else? Who else?
Do you reckon hiding knew about this or anything, or had a sense that it might be?
See, no one else can see them, and it's only... So Elytri knows that they exist, but he can't see them either. So he's aware that they are supposed to be there, but Beverly's the only one that can see them. And so the book kind of came from them. Because I'm kind of imagining when you get such a collection of spirits together, like, you know, that spirit was able to pick up the journal. And then there is this weird, crazy-ass book, which... So I started writing Priori when I was a teenager. I totally made that book. I bought myself some black velvet soda cover to go over the top of a notebook. Sewed a little Omega symbol into the with blue thread. I've got it somewhere. It's in a box somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That's going to be worth something one day.
Yeah,
totally. So I get that, like, they almost brought that book into being, you know, because you can create things out of line magic. I imagine, like, such a concentration of spirit energy would also be able to affect the lines of power in some sort of way. I don't know how yet. That's the mystery of being a writer. You just get feeling.
Oh, so it is a process of intuition for you in some ways.
Yes. Majority of ways.
I think for some writers more than others, it is. Because for mine, I kind of set up characters and just let them do their thing, and then you kind of write that out. And I think a lot of people do that. I don't know. But yeah, you just kind of you just go with how it feels. Because you can go back and edit later on to make it make a bit more logical sense or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm a bit more structured these days in how I write. Like, when I wrote Priori, I did it over the time span of 5 years. I didn't have a plan. I just kind of, if I got hit with writer's block, I just, like, stopped writing for 6 months until I got wind in my sails again and went back and, you know, off you go. But whereas these days I've been finding that I will fully, like, plan a whole heap of stuff out, but as I'm writing, all this just it's weird when you're in that headspace, things start connecting to each other without you being consciously aware of it. And I really love it when my brain makes those connections, but it doesn't make them easily, so sometimes it's like pulling nails.
I've got a world of respect for you guys as writers because, the fact that it's not 100% pulling nails, because whenever I have to do anything that's close to sort of this world of things, that's what it feels like the whole time. It's like beating my head against a wall.
I think it's all about training your brain to just make connections like that. I'm not really sure, but I feel like I find it easier now than I used to. But I don't know, maybe I'm just a bit more relaxed because I'm not doing it for assignments or something.
in some of Einstein's philosophies and speeches and stuff, he talks about how he thinks that there's like one massive like collective mind. So I feel like when I make those connections, I feel like my brain has like reached that, you know, reached like slightly above my head and through a couple of dimensions to this collective unconsciousness and just plucked a couple of things out and then cut the connection.
Okay.
When it comes to writing, there are two things that are happening. There's you conceiving of a story or sort of like Stephen King says, working as an archaeologist and uncovering a story that you find really compelling. And then you have to be able to execute it with words.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, those two things mesh well. For others, they don't mesh that well. But as always, a skill like that is a skill, and it takes practice. One of the things that I found really useful was doing my playwriting degree because it taught me to listen as opposed to dictate. I think when people are like, it's like pulling teeth, I understand how that feels. And sometimes it still feels that way because I'm too frustrated to listen. You know, I want to get it done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I find that if I'm writing something, the best stuff comes out when I'm using a light touch, even if I'm under pressure, even if I've got a deadline, even if I've got this concept that I desperately want to get down and my fingers are not fast enough to put the words onto phosphor.
Yeah, all right.
If I have a light touch, then things come out better. But that's such a combination of self-awareness and discipline that I don't get right 90% of the time.
Yeah.
When I briefly taught rhetoric, when I briefly taught introductory essay writing, everyone was like, oh, no, we're not writers. And I'm like, no. Do you take ideas and do you put them down on paper? Well, I mean, even a grocery list.
Well, yeah.
Well, then you're a writer to some degree or another.
Yeah.
You're taking ideas and you're putting them into written words, even if it's, you know, your kid's crayon on a receipt because that's all you have at hand and you need to remember to pick up eggs before you come home.
Yeah.
And I find it quite interesting that when people cite the fact that, you know, oh, they want to write a book, but, and the excuse they always go for is time. But I feel like that's not actually the, like, yes, things take time. All things take time. But it's not time. It's, as you say, Lois, it's the ability to make those connections.
And take it even a level above that, it's priorities, because I've been slapped on the wrist a few times by people sort of telling me this. And it's fair because, and it's something I'm trying to edit out of the language I use. Like, I don't say anymore that I don't have time for things. It's a matter of priorities because not to diminish the skills that we're talking about here, they're hard to learn and they're hard to craft, but they're worthwhile and you can get there. But it's, is it a priority enough for you to devote basically time to it? To actually get sufficient skills for you to be happy with what you're doing. Like, there's a real danger in, and I hope I didn't sound like I was coming across as doing this before, but there's a real danger when you mystify something that you're trying to elevate it beyond achievability. Yeah. You're like, I could never be that person, which excuses you from having to try.
You're absolutely right, and that happens, I think, with all of the arts, you know. Somebody says, oh, I'd love to be an actor, but oh, I just can't, because there's a story, there's a narrative built around what it means to be an actor, what it means to be a writer, what it means to be a painter or a sculptor. It's that general starving artist idea, and that's really scary.
Yeah, that makes Pete basically blow a gasket every time he hears it.
Yes! Absolutely, and rightly so, because there's absolutely nothing wrong with making money from a skill that you have worked on.
Yeah.
But I find that when it comes to the arts, there's this idea that there's no growth mentality. It's either you have talent or you don't, and that's nonsense.
Yeah. There's a quote from Will Smith who I think basically anyone would be happy having his career as it stands to this point and going, done, happy with that. And he's still doing great work, but like he talks about how like he doesn't see himself as exceptionally talented. He just had an exceptional work ethic. He did the work.
And you have to not be afraid of failing, and that is a huge deal because at least in the U.S., there's this enormous negative miasma built around the idea of failure. You can't fail. You can't afford to fail. If you fail, your life is over.
Yeah.
You know, and all of this harkens back to this particular episodes. You know, Beverly has those excuses that are laid before her where she's making things bigger than they are. And she has this epically massive fear of failure. Even though she has this great power, she doesn't have the finesse of control over it to be helpful. And as a result, she has this massive fear of failure, all except her fear is actually takes on a physical form. There are actually consequences for her if she does fail.
Yeah, it becomes too out of control for her to handle. Is that about your assessment of her... her limitations?
The lack of control, yes, but also lack of faith, because a lot of control comes in the faith that you have got this, that even if you don't have a process in place that you can figure something out on the fly.
Mm. Yeah.
Speaking of figuring things out on the fly, I wonder if this is going to tie in with the Alequine stuff with her and Shima. If she, you know, she's too busy trying to control Shima, and she needs to actually go with it and go with everything. And if she can go with the Priori, then she'll have better time using it. And instead of trying to use it, rather just letting it flow through her or something like that. I don't know. I haven't read that any further.
I feel like you would be correct. I'm a fan of awesome. And in this particular chapter as well, this kind of answers the question where, like, Sam in previous chats has kind of been like, what is the use of temporary immortality ring? What, like, how does that even work?
Yeah, right.
How, Sam, this is how. Yeah. All of those shadows you see around corners and things out the side of your eye. Mm. They wore this.
I was really impressed with the backstory. I guess the maturity of the writing really came out in this particular chapter. Yeah, I thought, oh my God, the backstory is so rich and so eloquently put onto the page. I was like, oh, I was enjoying the words so much.
It's like that moment where you get the origin story of the world kind of thing. Because we've only just had snippets every so often and what people sort of remember. And, you know, the Kraken's been this mysterious thing, but he's been a huge catalyst to everything that's happened. But this is the point where you see that catalytic reaction happen and you're like, oh, he was once a guy. It's like Voldemort was once a guy. It's
like, yeah, everything's coming together.
This is the part where you sit down a Lord of the Rings fan and you explain what's in the Silmarillion and they're like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
See, that's the problem that you get in a lot of fantasy is that the evil guy is just evil with no explanation of why they're evil or how that degradation into evil happened. Yeah. And I know a lot of you here are Star Wars fans, and I know that you guys hate the prequels that they put in front of the classic movies, but within, what's the one where he goes bad, the third one, right?
Is it
but when you watch that, I could just see the deterioration into madness, crazy bad guy. I had a look through my old notebooks the other day, and I have actually a whole plan, like a good skeleton of a plan out for actually the second Priori book, which I'd forgotten that I had, and it involves a lot of looking back into not only the Kraken's past, but also the past of Beverly's parents.
Oh, cool, because they're awesome as well.
That'd be so good.
And you learn why her mum's such an arsehole.
And in this corner, we've got the Kraken, and he's got a script. And in the other corner, actually, it's just the Kraken in his corner with the script. Cracking goodness.
Fatality.
So this iTunes app is Smart Thief on the Road, and it's by Abhishek Suazia. Okay, here we go. Smart Thief come with totally different but equally challenging game that make your brain use quickly fast, but accurately, so you should not waste any time to take this awesome challenge that has a lot of achievement are waiting for you. This game is all about to see how quickly and smartly you decide to choose any of the path you will encounter with one of the smart, craziest thief
if you allow thief to become smart thief. And who Guna love to do this, who have to pick magic box, and for picking, he need to solve this puzzle, related mystery, and how he use his strategy to complete each level. This gonna be totally different from others, in a lot of manner, as I show you before, think hard, fast, pick keys require for magic box, and collect coins and move further with ease, just like shot the key.
So what I'm getting from how to play this game...
I'm not getting anything.
is that you run over words, and the words that are left are then used...
Become the description of the game.
Yeah, seriously. Bless you, Colin, for, like, installing grammar as you read, because there is no grammar for you to follow. My absolute favorite right now is where it says most of the adventure place where thief go to pick keys and magic box also have few bullets that he can use to protect himself to complete levels fast as timer will danger for dangerous thief itself, isn't it?
God, what I really want to hear is the reviews in people's voices. I mean, come on.
Like goofy voices or our own personal voices?
No, in your characters' voices, your favorite characters. Yeah.
maybe okay. Some Sphinxes, guys.
Oh, yeah. It's completely addictive and a very good stress buster. Yeah. I have never played any game this addictive, and it's completely new concept game. This one is entertaining and make my brain use. It's also about how we handle our mind tickle in tough situations.
Oh, priceless.
Hugely awesome game with lots of challenges and achievements you need to earn are waiting for you.
Good shooting experience. Amit_Deli. Good shooting experience. Simple to play with lots of fun. Cool graphics and challenging game. Loved it! Exclamation mark.
Lois.
Very good game. By Vibob333. Could also be Whisker. I don't know. It's awesome graphics game and also good time pass with it. Thumbs up.
I really enjoyed basically quizzing David just to see what he would say at the end of episode 18. So I thought that I would do a Christmas-related 12 days of Christmas questions. But we're going to compress 6 of those days into 15 minutes.
Well done.
And so these questions, rather than just being for David, intern of Awesome and his eloquent popples, will be for everyone.
Yay!
And to make sure that we keep to our, I don't know, designated 15 minutes or whatever, I'm going to ask David to put his phone on a timer, and every 3 minutes we must move on to the next question.
Of course.
Three, two, one.
On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love said to me, if you found Santa passed out drunk on your living room floor after 12 too many sherries, what would you do?
Get up, you lazy bastard!
Cut open his sack.
Ouch!
Frankly, if he's passed out, he's obviously a bit of a drunkard. I would gladly take up his mantle and his sherries for him.
Oh, wow.
As long as you can't get DUIs while driving a reindeer pulled flying sled.
You would do this? What? You would become Claws?
There's milk and cookies to be had, and I'm going to have them.
Only the stingy families give milk and cookies.
What the fuck? What are you calling me?
The rest of sherries and cookies, isn't that
nice? Well, look at Emily and her rich family.
I know, right?
When I was a lad, we were lucky if Santa got a glass of water.
When Lois first answered this question, I hadn't put like the drunking 12 sherries part in there. And Lois's first response was, we should give him insulin.
I think that's good. I think that's responsible.
Yeah.
We had to live in shoebox in the middle of road with chimney. And Santa Claus was stick figure coming down. Got burnt at the bottom.
What would you do, Lois? What would you do?
Give the poor guy insulin, because clearly he's had too many goddamn cookies.
David?
And get him into the recovery position?
Yeah. You know, potentially clear out the airway in case he's going to, you know, vomit while he's passed out.
Yeah. And maybe give him some sherry, some brandy or something to bring him around.
I do not think alcohol works the way you think it's working.
Before our 3 minutes is up, I'd like to give you guys Sam's pre-prepared answer to this question, which is blackmail.
Next one.
On the 11th day of Christmas, my true love said to me, does the Christmas cheer brought by Rudolph outweigh his clearly communist leanings?
It is a red nose. It's such a red nose.
It is.
Like a light bulb.
Mm. Yeah, but he's not, but his participation in the actual reindeer team is not very communist. It's
what
quite...
is he doing? He's distributing wealth to the entire of the world. Everyone.
Yeah, but if we bring it back down to the environment of just the reindeer, it's quite hierarchical. And he, in fact, has ascended to a position of power through no real skill of his own.
Some kids are getting coal and some kids are getting presents. It's so unequal. Yeah. I mean, it's not a matter of the bourgeoisie getting all the presents and the proletariat getting all the coal. There's mix-ups, of course,
I think,
but
it's still
unequal.
It's a bit of propaganda as well because, you know, it's like, oh, look at the red nose. Look at how shiny it is. Look at how great I am. And yeah, and he's got sacks of coals in the back.
And not only that, there's implications of genetic engineering because, you know, how many reindeer actually have any kind of bioluminescence?
I think it's kind of odd that... okay, Santa Claus has a lot of red on him, but who's the star? Really? Who's the red star? It's Rudolph, isn't it?
Who illuminates his way through the darkness of Christmas night for a clear path forward?
The conspiracy goes even further because originally Santa was dressed more in blues and silvers, but then Coca-Cola decided to use him as an advertising gimmick, and that's how he got his traditional red and white duds.
If I can slide on in here with Sam's response, it is, yes, but it doesn't quiet the nightmares about his childhood.
Nice. Next question, please.
On the 10th day of Christmas, my true love sent to me. What do you think the sentence would be for billions of B&E charges? Also, does delivering presents count as community service?
So he's actually, like, performing his sentence while he's doing the crime.
Huh. It's a perpetual cycle, so when he breaks and enters, his, like, sentence is to do community service of giving gifts to the poor children around the world, and so
requiring...
it's just, like, a perpetual cycle of crime and redemption. So Sam's response to this was, the sentence would be that until you were released, you'd have to deliver toys to all the houses you broke into. Oh.
Oh, God. He climbs down the chimney, he's like, bursts in. Sorry, sorry, sorry. I'll just leave this here. Sorry, sorry. I'm really sorry. I'll just be going now. Sorry, sorry. I accidentally broke in. Accident. Oh, ooh, Sherry. Oh, God. Sorry.
Like, he's like a master vigilante. He just has Mrs. Claus verified that he was home all night on Christmas night. And he's not Santa Claus at all. She's his Alfred the butler, I suppose.
That'd be brilliant.
I want to see, like, that is like a Usual Suspects story with, like, you know, Santa in the interrogation room.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
It's Sinterklaas. It's Sinterklaas. Who is Sinterklaas?
All right, next question.
On the 9th day of Christmas, my true love said to me, how fire retardant and or frictionless is Santa and the sleigh, considering he has to be traveling at FTL to visit all of those houses in a small period of time all over the world? Plus, that he's climbing down chimneys that are usually on fucking fire.
He's just displaced in a quantum sense. He's actually in more than one place at once.
Oh.
But it's all about quantum displacement. It's actually not very difficult.
That makes all the sense.
I'm sorry, but I'm just imagining a frictionless Santa.
Can't even get on the sleigh. Whoa, hey!
All the presents slip out of his hands like soap in the cartoon.
Zoink!
So, you know, frictionless Santa inside of his frictionless sleigh.
It needs to have some elements of Velcro to him so he can stick in the seat for long enough and then...
This Christmas Eve, frictionless Santa.
Order now and receive a free magic box with a mystery prize.
What was Sam's answer?
Super fire retardant and like the most frictionless.
Like, the most frictionless. None more frictionless.
God damn. He's really got a penchant for accuracy.
Yeah. If you think about it, if it really is frictionless, you just give it a slight push. And it would just never stop. You wouldn't even need reindeer. The reindeer would be lazy sloth.
On the eighth day of Christmas, my true love said to me, if Santa gives gifts based on merit, why is it that kids from wealthier families are often given better gifts?
Oh, I kind of almost answered this, didn't I, before, with the coal and stuff.
Haven't you seen, like, on Facebook, there's a post going around that says, hey, this Christmas, if you've got a lot of money, you know, say that the toys are from you, but that the underwear and the, you know, and the socks are from Santa, so that when the kids go back to school come January or February, those kids who don't have parents who can afford the Xbox don't feel super crummy.
In my family, the tradition has been, our parents would do it, and they would just put all the stuff that was in the stocking was from Santa.
Cool.
And so it was just like chocolates and, you know, all the stuff that you eat and then feel sick.
Yeah.
So like wind-up toys and things too.
Well, don't eat the wind-up toys. No wonder you're sick.
Yeah. I need machine parts inside me. The singularity is coming.
So Sam's response to this is, because wealthy people are better people than poor people, and deep down, poor people know it's true.
Oh,
we should eat the poor.
Sam. Contentious.
Next question.
On the seventh day of Christmas, my true love said to me,
in these times of austerity, how can we trust that Santa isn't on selling his naughty nice list to government surveillance groups around the world? How safe are the North Pole's servers from data hacking?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cold environment, which means like you have supercomputers and stuff, but I just assume that my data is pretty much spread around the internet like, oh, I don't know, popcorn at a park? I can't really come up with a good analogy.
I was going to go with herpes, but...
I was trying to avoid the...
1 in 4 computers has Lois's information.
That pigeon's gone off with my credit card number.
It's weird. This document just pops up once a year.
I'm just really promiscuous with my data entry.
God damn it.
Hold on. So, what would, like, so if you were a government agency, why would you buy a naughty and nice list? Is that so that you don't have to go through the work of, like, setting up your terrorist watch list?
I think if I were the tax office, I would be interested in that list.
Finally, to end the seventh question of Christmas, it's Sam's answer, which is, it's safer to assume it's all being sold on. Also, Santa uses Norton to tell me how hackable it is.
Emily, you went to GenreCon ages ago.
Yay!
And we want to hear all about it.
GenreCon was fun as always. A great range of genre authors from all different walks of life, you know, everywhere from romance and erotica to thrillers to crime to fantasy. And I ended up chairing my first GenreCon panel.
Oh, nice. What about, was it?
About indie publishing. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure I managed to steer it away from the stereotypical, what is Facebook? Smell of books.
Oh, my God.
Killing our industry, which is the normal rabbit holes those panels go down. Mm. And I'm pretty sure I managed to steer it away from that, but we still got questions from the audience basically being like, how do I set up my website? And what social media should I be using? And I'm just like, oh.
Mm-hmm. No. The conversation on the table, and it seems to be quite a divisive one about self-publishing versus indie publishing through sort of small press.
I think that everybody is now sort of coming to accept the fact that you can go a whole multitude of different ways, which will then lead into all of those three simultaneously, one after the other, whatever, in circular order. You know, there's no sort of set path anymore, and I just wanted to make that a positive conversation, because a lot of time when people are like, oh my god, there is not a step-by-step thing that I can follow, they freak the shit out. So I was trying to make it a thing of, exploration and discovery, and, you know, it may not be for you and it may not be your personality type, you know. You also go into a lot of indie things where people are like, this is the way, this is how you get published, this is the only way you can do it if you can't get into it. And I feel like that's not true. It is not the right way for all authors. It is completely a personality dependent thing. One of my favorite presentations at GenreCon was one given by Karen Warren, who normally writes sort of horror stories, creepy, very creepy stories. Mm-hmm. And she did this amazing presentation, which was basically to take you down all of the research rabbit holes she had for this particular story that she was looking at writing, where she had gone to a school fete. She had found a pack of boxed postcards, like old school vintage postcards, but they'd all been written on in the back. And so she went through and started reading them all, and it was from a very famous painter, Australian painter, who was liked by, I think it was Robert Menzies or something, one of the Australian prime ministers. And she ended up delving into his relationship with the prime minister, and then like a whole heap of murders that had happened. What? And and she got like a fellowship to do a whole heap of research at Parliament House. Ooh. As part of it. And it was just one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard, because I just love to see how people follow stories and discover things. I really love watching those rabbit holes. So that was amazing. And then the other amazing person who was there was a woman by the name of Mary Robinette Cowell, who is not only a writer of fantasy, she writes Regency fantasy, but she is also a puppeteer. Mm-hmm. So she has been the right hand of Oscar the Grouch on Sesame Street. She gave an amazing, as part of her like speech for the GenreCon banquet, she gave us a mini puppet show, shadow puppet show. She started it off by saying, I've been told that I have to rise up to the expectations of Chuck Wendig's previous GenreCon banquet speech. And to that I say, fuck you, Chuck Wendig.
Oh, man.
And then went on from there. So that was very funny. And then she's also a voiceover actor. So had epic hour-long conversation with her about accents and what part of her practice does she like doing the most. Is there anything that like her heart truly belongs to? And one thing that was interesting was that I was trying to teach her to speak with an Australian accent, and every time she tried to follow me, it came out British. But when we got one of the guys who was from the Queensland country to say the same sentence to her, she got it like that.
Ah, yes, because, you're an educated Australian. Educated Australians are accent.
Very posh Australian accent, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you are. And there's so many Australian
accents. Kind of accent that gives brandy to Santa.
Kind of accent that gets Santa sloshed so he can't deliver any of the presents.
Because I can afford it.
Those were the highlights of GenreCon for me. That and GenreCon karaoke. Which I missed last time, but got to take part in this time.
Oh, nice.
Is that different from normal karaoke, or is it?
It is full of publishing types singing karaoke.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
What was your favorite panel that you got to see that you didn't, you weren't sharing?
There was one that was called The Art of Misdirection. And when is it okay to misdirect your readers? When is it self-indulgence? How careful do you have to be about misdirecting your readers? Like if you do like an unreliable narrator, how far can you take that? You know, how pissed off are people going to be if you completely, you know, misdirect them and then pull like random twists that don't make sense and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, right.
And I'm afraid it's bedtime for all of us here at Priori. So, it's goodbye from me, goodbye from Colin, goodbye from Kevin, goodbye from Lois, and a big goodbye from Emily Craven.
Bye, Grill.
Hey, this bobby pin isn't working. Hey.
Less pressure, Lois.
Oh, shelved and delivered.
Very nice. All right, guys, that's a wrap.
Oh, I thought it was a sandwich. dive deep into challenge and earn the reward as achievement. Thief gonna be crazy achievement. Genius. Oh, wow. Are you ready to allow Thief to become Smart Thief, not smarter than Ooh? What the fuck is this game about? I don't fucking get it.
And you just know they're going to turn into a movie in a few years.
Thumbs up the magic
box. Jason Statham is the smart thief.
Yeah, yeah, smart thief. And it'll be smarter by the same people who made Prince of Persia. You know.
I've got to find a way to pick the magic box.
Oh no!
Smart thief is going to be crazy.
But don't you know that you will get many opportunities to boost your game coins?
I don't care about my game coins. I just want to get that box unpicked.
We'll be ready to use them in between levels or outside the level 2 if you need to boost your game timer.
Mate, I was born ready.
And then there's that zany story about hiding and Carp hanging out, chilling out. And one's really boring and the other one's kind of
what?
Mean.
Kraken's not here, Dave. What?
Should I introduce you introducing that? Or is
sure,
that
little... do that.
Do you want to be introduced, David?
Yeah, could someone please introduce me? To... but enough of these introductions. Well, Emily, it's December already, and I was wondering, did you have something to share with us all as some kind of Christmas present?
Wow. I'm sorry, what is a wee Ferrari?
You figure it out!
Whispering into my ear as I slumber.
How would an elf quite even hold a gun?
This is gonna be totally Heartwink Adventure for you.
Oh my god, Heartwink Adventure.
Totally Heartwink Adventure is gonna be my new anime cover band.
Yeah, that cool. Would be, I would listen to that.
That is right? How awesome would that be?
Yeah.
Priori, it's a Heartwink Adventure.
Right. Hey everyone, welcome to our Cowboy Bebop Marathon. But before we start, we have Totally Heartwink Adventure here. Just to play a few tunes for us. So grab your Kyren beer and enjoy.
It almost also sounds like it should be a crime solving show. Like Inspector Heartwink of Crime Squad.
It's a Totally Heartwink Adventure.
Damn it, Heartwink, I'm sick of your adventures.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go and hug your secretary.
Hi. This smart thief cold. Is outsmarted us again.
Hi, you've called Heart Thief.
I'm going to shoot your key.
Ping. Do you like to touch my magic box?
Heartwink.
Used to love picking my magic box.
Well, it's a bit too creepy. Bit too creepy. Yep. Less creepy.
Okay.
Priori the Podcast is a full cast audio of the fantasy novel Priori, written by Emily Craven, the author of the Grand Adventures of Madeline Kane series. The podcast is produced by Emily Craven and Kevin Powell and contains the voiceover talents of Emily, Kevin, Sam Piaggio, Colin Smith and Lois Spangler. Intro and outro music is thanks to composer Christopher Healy. Our audio intern is the amazing David Fithian. Each weekly episode contains a chapter of Priori, as well as a gag reel and chat with the cast. To find out more about Priori, Emily, the cast, or to sign up to the newsletter of Awesome, go to www.originalfantasy.com/Priori Podcast. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please consider while you're at the website donating the price of a cup of coffee towards us paying our wonderful voiceover actors. These guys have freely donated their time for this project, and Emily would like to shower them with riches so they'll consider creating more podcasts with her and for you in the future.